My name is Mike Fran. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. I'm from the correctional committee. We happen to have a table in the back that we're trying to look for volunteers to go inside of the facilities. And for 12-step work, it's a great chance of doing 12-step work. So if you'd visit the gentleman in the back, Mike C., he'd love to take your name and number and try to get you guys active in 12-step work behind the walls.
And women.
Men and women. There's both in here, right? Okay. So with no other further ado, I'd like to give you Tom I. Thanks.
We're back again. Things have scared a bunch off. They're in mission jail. Some run for the hills, don't they? Tom Iverson, an alcoholic. I think what I'm going to do, it's a bad assumption to assume everybody was there last night, but I'm not going to really get into an in-depth thing about my own story. I'll use the experience wherever it's convenient, but in this session I really would like to sort of get into to issues, because there are a lot of things that that people worry about who are doing work in corrections. A lot of aggravations and frustrations and things that you do, and so I want to be maybe even more content oriented with this one a little bit. I just suffice it to say that I wound up in a prison when I was 24 years old. Not a clue that I was alcoholic. Got recommended to Alcoholics Anonymous, walked in, slowly but surely found a real solution for myself. And in the course of that experience, I became a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I found in a penitentiary, and I think it's fairly basic fundamental to the kind of thrust I want to do here, I don't think there's anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't do before I left the institution. There was no new world out here to do. It was a matter of doing the same kinds of activities, the same kind of service, the same kind of responsibility that I did on the outside. And for some people, that may be the very best place to find Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if it would be. I've suggested that to a lot of people. I've never had anybody say, geez, I'd like to try that. You know? So that's probably the way it ought to be. But for me, it was truly a life experience, and a life-saving, life-changing experience. And what it's convinced me is, I was chatting with somebody at Breaker just right before the meeting, Kevin, I believe, right before the meeting, that some people say that Alcoholics Anonymous in an institution isn't like Alcoholics Anonymous on the street. Well, obviously, it's the same program. My real belief is that in terms of the power and vitality of the program, it isn't the same. It has to be stronger, because the greatest threats that I've ever had in my life were in the 3.5 years that I lived in that institution. No street in any city in this country has ever given me the kind of discomfort that was my everyday experience there. And if you think you want to get tested some, try it on a maximum custody prison yard. And I'll guarantee you, you'll find out what you made out of real quick. And if you want a program that'll pull you above that thing and give you a life that has dignity and worth, you find the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this program worked as well for me locked up at Jackson Prison as it ever has anywhere. And I am deeply grateful for that. And so that when I hit the street, it was just a matter of keeping on with what I was doing. I didn't have to learn a whole new repertoire. All I had to do was keep doing the stuff that I was already doing. And so it has. I'm not dogmatic or adamant about stuff so much. I've got some beliefs. I've got some things that I've come to believe over the years that are my beliefs. It doesn't make them right, but they're things that I just feel rather strongly about. And if you have feelings strongly in a different direction, that's fine. I would respect that. Somebody was asking me about I think he did, is asking me about if I sponsored people, did I try to make them be as active as me? And I said, no, I don't. Because I fully believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is filled with people who grow at different paces in different directions. We're not clones, you know. We're people who find our own route. And so, no, I don't try to push people into looking like me and acting like me. I want them to find their own solution and find their own life. And my job is to help them do that with some integrity. And same way with stuff about corrections. I'll throw out some stuff, and it's not that I want to sell you on anything or try to browbeat you with anything, but I want to get to some things that I've come to believe about working in the prison environment. When I'm working in a prison environment, fundamental to something that I want to always keep in mind is that I'm working with alcoholics, not convicts. I'm working with alcoholics. I'm working with people who are no different than me. Some people have a belief that people who are in prison are somehow different than those of us on the street. I don't find that to be true. I've got a good buddy down in North Carolina who says that after working in prisons for a few years, what he's concluded is that the only difference is that inmates tend to have fewer teeth and more tattoos than others. And I'm inclined to agree with that. That's all I got, though. Tattoo folks never would let me take my clothes off. That's kind of fundamental. You know, because if I'm going to work with somebody carrying the message, you know, I've got to have at first a genuine respect and belief that that person is somebody that I can carry the message to that I've got. And it doesn't need a new kind of language. You know, I have people very often, and I don't get on their case about it, because I know what they're talking about. But it used to really agitate me in a way when people would come into the institution and you see it, who would say that what they would try to do was talk our language. What language is that? I mean, I speak the same language as everybody else that speaks English. I know the first time I went back to Michigan, I'd been out about 2 years. I was going to state convention. I was going to go down and visit Jackson, my first visit. And so I met a real nice guy in a three-piece banker suit, standing at the hotel, and a really nice guy. And we visited, and he said, were you looking for somebody? I told him who I was looking for, and he said, oh, yeah, that's Pete. He does a lot of work in the prison. I said, yeah, that's where we met. And this guy, really good man, I know, he said, well, that's really good. You know, Pete speaks you fellows' language. Well, I mean, it just hit me wrong, as it always did. And I said, what language is that? Well, he got embarrassed, you know, and he was flustered because he understood what I was talking about. And he said, you know what I mean? I said, sure I do. Sure I do. But when we go in with that mindset, what we do is create barriers. We don't lower them. We create them. And so I always like to keep it in mind that what I'm dealing with is alcoholics, not convicts. We'll let somebody else deal with convicts. And when I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, that's what I want to do. And that's fundamental to the dialogue, that I'm not doing something different. The other thing I like to keep in mind as a fundamental consideration is that a new and different program is not needed. What I have observed for the last 43 years and believe with all my heart is that people in prison recover exactly like you and me. Now, I don't care where you got it, whether it was Hazelden or in off the street or wherever. I think they recover exactly like you and me, exactly the same kind of program. It's to me, it looks like a program of experiential learning. And that people get recovered not by watching somebody else do it or listening to somebody else's explanation. people recovery by getting caught up in the process. And so very fundamental to me when I'm working with folks in the institution is that the rules don't change. And that conditions how I go about working with folks. I'm going to get into that just a little bit more. Let me mention just a couple other kind of takeoffs on this idea of how you approach folk in prison. I try to dress decent for any meeting I attend. I don't overdo it. I wore a jacket here today, but damn, it's hot. And I respect Alcoholics Anonymous as much as anybody in this universe, but I also respect heat. And I try to dress appropriately, and I do that going to a prison. Yeah, I like to remember when I walk into a prison that I'm a walking example of what some of those guys are hoping is going to happen for them. And so I want to look like somebody who not only carries himself like a sober person, but somebody who respects the occasion, who respects them enough to dress appropriately. And so I do that. That doesn't mean that I go in a business suit, but it means that I'm going to be clean, I'm going to be neat, and I'm not going to go in there in my soccer shorts. You know, I'm going to go in there looking like somebody who has respected that meeting enough to look like I did. So I do that. You don't have to, but I do. I wish I had the language thing. I wish I had my glasses is what it is. I can't see this stuff till I get it just focused just right. Language. Let me say this about language. Now, this is just me personally. I'm a pretty clean guy. I'm an extremely clean guy at the podium. I respect the podium. I respect the responsibility that's involved. See, it's just like you sitting here today. I don't know who you are. I don't know who you brought here. You know, somebody may have their mother here. Somebody may have their child here. Somebody may be deeply religious. And I'm simply not going to take a license to impose my values on you. I have never insulted anybody in 43 years by not swearing. Never had a soul say, man, you don't cuss much. Not a one. I've had thousands of people say, thanks for keeping it decent. And so I do that. And I do that when I go into a prison. Yeah. Some people come in, and it goes back to that thing I was talking about. Some people go into a prison, and they feel some holy obligation. It goes under that heading of talking their language. To use the most gross, vulgar language imaginable. And the idea, I guess, is to overcome discomfort or something, or to make it look like you're one of the guys. I don't know what it is. But people will go at it that way with the notion that this is going to get the attention of the folk there, talking their language. I'll assure you that playground garbage ain't going to impress nobody in a penitentiary. It ain't going to impress nobody. And the way I always look at it, and would invite you to consider it, that, you know, a week in prison is made up just like any other week in the year, just like it is for us. It's 7 days, 24 hours a day, 168 hours a week. It just seems longer in a prison. But it's exactly the same number of hours. And the way I always like to keep in mind, just to help, I don't need a lot of keeping me in line. I've sort of taken it as a principle now. But the way I try to keep in mind the importance of that, when I look back to my experience, I lived in a world that was vile and rude and contentious and dangerous 24 hours a day. I mean, rotten language was the norm, to say nothing of behavior. The only place in my week where I had some decency, some dignity, some peace, an environment that had at least a healing quality, was in the group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I appreciated everybody who came in that institution, but I came close to not appreciating people who came in and polluted it. And so I look at it that way, that it doesn't mean that I'm a saint. It means that I respect the occasion and be realistic, that what will impress a guy in prison, to my way of thinking, is that you stand on principles and you stand for something you believe in. Respect that. It won't be that coarse kind of stuff that says, yeah, I'm one of the guys. In dealing with folks in prison, I like to keep a couple of things in mind that grow out of this kind of thing I'm talking about. Has anybody got any reading glasses? This is hopeless. I don't know who wrote this. Here, let's see if this is going to work. Sometimes they will. Yeah, this will do it, I think. Right. Thanks very much, Dad. Yeah. You think I'm still manly? Yeah. Now, I don't know in the early days of the joint if I would have let a woman give me glasses and put them on. Somebody would have married me that day. I don't think y'all going to do that. But in dealing with guys, and it kind of grows out of this stuff, my basic approach is this. You know, I've had a lot of people over the years, you know, when they find out I had a little understanding about me, say, yeah, you're different. Oh, yeah, I am different. I'm different because most people, when they first meet me, see me as a fairly warm and easygoing, generous guy. And I've had a lot of guys say, well, you know, you're different because you've been there. Yep, that's right. I've been there. I've also come back. And I understand what's involved in coming back. And so underneath all of it is that I'm probably as tough on guys in a prison. I don't mean pushing them around, but in terms of expecting appropriate kinds of stuff, taking a level of responsibility, I'm probably tougher than the average guy, both as an employee and as a volunteer. What I've come to believe is that I ought not to do anything for the guys that they can and should do for themselves. A lot of people approach this kind of work with the notion that these are helpless people who can't do anything. That's just not true. Not true. That if they can and should do it for themselves, well, I'll give you an example. I went into a prison one day in North Carolina, walked in with a bunch of guys going into an AA meeting. And it was kind of amusing in a way. We drove up, and this was a small prison. And there were about a half dozen guys coming in from the outside. So we drove up. The guys opened the trunks of their cars and took out the coffee pot. These are the volunteers. The literature. Everything. Carried it into the meeting place. Made the coffee. Here are hundreds of inmates standing there watching the parade. So after the meeting, somebody said, what'd you think? I said, well, you guys sure working hard. But you ever think about you're not giving the guys a chance to get a piece of the action? Well, nobody's standing there watching that parade that wouldn't have welcomed the opportunity to get in on it. Give us a hand. Come on, man, help me tote this thing. It's heavy. Yeah, but sometimes we do it. We think we get caught up in that duff that we're doing service and therefore we ought to be the servant 100%. But when we do something, it's the old stuff you've heard all your life. When you do something for somebody that they could and should do for themselves, you don't help them, you hurt them. Exactly the same thing. You know, in a prison, the way I like to apply that, if a guy can read, he ought to read. You know, I go in sometimes, and every single thing that's done is done by the outsiders. Everything. And inmates sit there as idle spectators. I went out to State Washington just recently, and it was wonderful people. We were going to two different prisons, two different days. I got in on the afternoon. We drove in typical Washington weather, rain and fog everywhere. Couldn't see a thing. They tell me all the wonderful scenery. I said, yeah, I bet it is. Couldn't see a thing. And we drove forever out through the boondocks, drove up to a penitentiary, walked in, and it was one of those where outsiders did every single thing that was done. Everything. Inmates did absolutely nothing. That was a prison with about 1,000 people. It may not be shocking to you that we had probably a max of 10 people at that meeting. There was no life going on. There was no membership. There was no energy. There was no action. You know, this were a group of spectators who showed up to watch the activity once a week. A little bit more time to give folks a chance to do something. So just sort of an action with me. If they can do it for themselves, I'm not going to help if I do it for them. It's the same thing in working with a group. And what I'm talking about is a little bit of both of that. In working with a group, very important for me to help people find a way to get in on it and to carry it out. And I would much rather see somebody clumsily stumble through reading chapter 5 than for me to read it. My God, you know, I don't need to read it anymore, no time soon. Particularly when there's a newcomer that can get something from doing that. And so, you know, that's basic stuff, but it's pretty important stuff that we sometimes overlook. When I go into prison, I like to keep it in mind, it's like walk like you talk. And I mean, that's a cliche, but let me tell you what I'm talking about. Well, I'll tell you one other thing. First time I ever went into a women's prison. A long time ago, and I was still a pretty sharp-looking dude. And if I'd have been 80, I'd have been sharp-looking to some of those folks. They'd been there a long time. And so, you always wonder about, you know, how women react to men ogling and all this stuff. I went walking across the yard, and one of them whistled at me, you know. Well, hell, all at once I couldn't walk, you know. I'm trying to get a figure out. But that's not what I'm talking about, that kind of walk. That was nothing to what some of them said to me a little later on. That I won't go into. But walking like you talk is awfully important in a prison. I hope you understand this way. I'm going to say it. You will never deal with a more critical group of people in your life. Now, I don't mean criticism, but I'm talking about a group who listens critically or watches critically what you're doing. Because, you know, you're dealing with people, as a rule, who have stopped trusting. You know, who really feel like they're in mortal combat with the world, you know, and any of its representatives. And so when we walk in thinking people are just going to roll over just because the hero's shown up, You know, I think, don't have any basis for this other than just experience, but I think it takes about 6 months to earn enough trust that it'll really register with folks in prison. It takes that long. It's one reason that commitments are so important, you know, not just one-time wonders, that thing of going back, demonstrating time and again that it's for real. I tell you a thing that you probably see a little of that in this. I had a guy call me one day at he was with Ringling Brothers Barnum Bailey Circus. And I never had talked to anybody. Well, I tried to get in it one time when I was drunk, but they wouldn't take me. This guy was with Ringling Brothers, and he called up, and he said, somebody told me I ought to call you if I got in this town. I said, well, I'm glad you called. And he said, I don't have any transportation except for train, and I don't believe I can get it. He said, you think you could come by here? I said, well, I think I could probably work that out. And he said, well, since you're coming, how about bringing me a ham sandwich? Well, I kind of smelled a rodent right then. I mean, just the way he put it, that kind of Slick Willie type stuff. And so I said, yeah, I'll spot you a ham sandwich. So I grabbed the thing, went out there. And it so happened I had an opening over at the prison that night to speak for a speaker. Some guy couldn't make it. I said, funny you called, because we need a speaker tonight over at the prison. You're it. And that was an expensive ham sandwich, I tell you. I took that old boy over there that night, and that guy spoke, and this is God's truth, that guy spoke the entire time and never made eye contact with one person. Not one. Wonder why. Yeah. He knew those guys read him like a book. And that guy spoke for the whole time looking at that podium. And that's what I'm talking about. You know, it's people that you don't fool readily because they're super sensitive to what you see, will tend to be. And so that's why I think it's so important about how we relate to that. It doesn't mean a performance. It's just a matter of being straight up with who you are and what you're about. And that'll tend to be respected an awful lot. I think it's awfully important because of some of those reasons to do what you say you're going to do. People in prison, I don't know about Illinois, but every prison I've ever been, people live with false promises of people saying, yeah, I'll check on that. Yeah, I'll take care of that. Yeah, I'll look into that. And it almost never happens. And so when they see us, very important if we say, yeah, I will see you next Tuesday, to see you next Tuesday, to be back. You know, and to walk like we talk, because that's what breeds trust. And if we don't do that, what we do is make a sham of the whole deal. Don't preach. Don't preach. It's a temptation. And a lot of people can't resist it. They get in there with that much criminality locked up and sin by the acre. And some people just cannot resist preaching and telling folks what they ought to do. I've been getting advice all of my life. I don't know if I've ever taken any of it. The only way I'm willing to take advice is if somebody is willing to spend enough time to fully understand my situation. And most aren't. And most advice is just sort of casually thrown out and promptly ignored. And to me, that's what's so important. You know, it's always intrigued me about prisons that there's a guy used to come to one down in North Carolina that, to me, it was almost demented the way this guy would do. He was one of those kind of violent preachers. That, I mean, nothing wrong with preaching, but he was one of those violent kind of times that come in and he just preach that hellfire and damnation. Inmates loved him. My God, they just loved him. And I always wondered why. I mean, why on earth would you do that? And then I heard somebody talk one time about expiation of guilt, you know, and how we'll tend to seek out folks that'll beat us up so we feel better. Doesn't make us any better, just because we feel better if we get the beating we deserve. I don't want to be that person who delivers the beating they deserve, and so I don't want to preach to folk. Usually when I talk to a prison group, the first thing I'll say is I ain't going to advise nobody about nothing. I ain't got no advice to offer. I ain't going to tell nobody how to do it. You know, what I'll do is share the experience, strength, and hope. If it has meaning, great. If not, it's okay. And sort of go at it that way. Share experience, strength, and hope. Ironically, I was a screwball guy. I wasn't a member of the mafia or anything like that. I wasn't a predatory criminal. I was a guy, I was an alcoholic who did an awful lot of damage. And one reason I think it's so important to be who we are, I never identified with anybody who was some kind of a real go-get-em gangster type. I never identified. That wasn't who I was. I was an alcoholic whose alcoholism got him into a penitentiary. It was not a criminal who drank. There's a big difference in that. And the first person that I ever identified with, I wouldn't have believed. The first person I ever really identified with after about 2 years was a guy who had never been in jail in his life. Never. He came to that prison one time, and I swear to God, I think somebody conned him into coming. I don't think he knew where he was going. They told him they were going on a picnic or something, and the first thing you know, he's in the big stone. And this guy, I swear, I've seen a lot of people that were uneasy. This guy, they called him up to the front to speak. And he was petrified. I mean, it wasn't so much petrified of speaking, he was petrified of where he was. And the whole time he spoke, he kept looking behind him, you know, to see if anybody's sneaking up on him. And he was so nervous, he spoke in a falsetto. He sounded like Tiny Tim singing with that thing. And that guy laid it out for a few minutes. That's the first guy I ever really identified with. Yeah. Because that was one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Yeah. And to me, that's what's so important about sharing what we are. I want to talk about two more things, and then we'll start some chatting here a little bit. Two things. One is about in setting up a meeting, setting up a group. I talked to some folks last night. In fact, we were talking a little bit about setting up a group. We've got good procedures laid out in AA material, but the fact of the business is we normally ignore it. And most of the time what we do is say, let's go do a meeting and go over to prison, and they'll say, yeah, meet Tuesday night, and then take off and then hope it'll work. Yeah. And that's not the way it's laid out, and I think it's a bad mistake. Yeah. When you'll find this in the material, but you won't find it much in practice, but it's something that I have really come to believe is vital. That if you're going to do a meeting in an institution, in any kind of a controlled environment, the first meeting must be with the administration of that facility. To go over the basic game plan for what you're going to do. Do you want a meeting? Have you got a place for it? Are there inmates here? How will they get to the meeting? You know, all of the conditions of a meeting. What are the constraints? How will volunteers get cleared to get in? You know, to meet with that administration and see if they are prepared to engage in hosting a group in that institution. If they're not, they'll beat you to death. And very important to do that. And so normally, here's what I normally recommend that to anybody going in, I do it myself. In fact, we're doing it in my home group, we're doing it with a county jail. Week from next Tuesday, 16th of May. And what we're going to do in that little old county jail in a rural town in North Carolina, we've got the sheriff, the chief deputy, and the administrator of the jail. And we're going to meet for 1 hour, not 1 hour and 5 minutes, we're going to meet for 1 hour, max. And we may quit early if we can. And what we're going to do is basically this. We've got the thing, if you want to see the format for that, look in a little green pamphlet called AA in Prisons. And you'll see the format for doing such a meeting. And what we're going to do is find out what that jail can provide. You know, what is it that they can provide in terms of a place to do a meeting? And so we'll get that neutralized. If they tell us things that we're not ready to agree with, what we'll say to them is, we will go and talk to our folks, and we'll get back with you and let you know what we can do. That'd be just like buying a car. You know, somebody's got a car, and then you set a deal. And then when we get agreement, based on not violating their policies and not violating our traditions, what we'll do is write a letter to the sheriff and say, hey, guy, appreciate meeting with you. Here's what we agreed on. And that becomes almost like a sales contract. And so if we have problems later on, you know, the shift changes every 8 hours. And there's always somebody that didn't read the letter. You know? And that's one reason I like to get the letter, because when there's a rub, and there'll be rubs, you got a base document to go back to. Now, that's business. That's just good business. When I meet with people in criminal justice, I always set a time limit. Because they expect you to try to talk them to death, and we'll tend to do that if they'll let us. It's always set a time limit and try to surprise them by ending quick. They're time machine type people. And so I like to do it in a real brisk kind of way. I don't expect them to understand traditions. That's our job. I expect them to understand their policy. And so if we can do that and they can afford a place for a meeting, great. That's what we do. If they can't, we won't. We'll go do something else. That, to me, is one of the finest investments of time that we can make. If we go back and they say the only time we've got is at 1 o'clock Friday afternoon, our question will be, can we afford that? If we don't have anybody that's retired, ready to go, we may not be able to afford that. So that's what we have to do. Business-like kind of thing. The last thing I want to talk about is this. I see a lot of, run into a lot, I referee a lot, of problems that generate over a lack of clarity about what we do and what our responsibilities are. And it nearly always when we have trouble is because we don't clearly understand enough what our deal is. Let me give you an example of what I think at least is one illustration of how the responsibilities distinguish. When we agree to do something in an institution, we don't write a job description, but if we did, here's what my job description would say. For the jail or the prison administration or the probation keeper or whoever it is, I want two things. That's all I want from them. Two things. I want them to provide an environment, provide a place for it to be done, a setting for it to be done, that will support and encourage what we're trying to do. That's all I want. I want an environment that will promote and encourage what we're trying to do. Now, you can take that as far as you want to. At a minimum, I want an environment where you can conduct a meeting. Sometimes you go into an institution and the environment is so calamitous that you can't conduct a meeting. You know, with whistles blowing, pots rattling, traffic up and down. To me, it's better to not do a meeting than to do one that's totally undermined by the factors around it. So part of my negotiation, I would want to be, is there an environment where this can be done? Part of the environment is also the attitude of the people. Are the staff, and I know that you can't guarantee this across the board, but the environment is all of what surrounds. And if folks are doing this against their will, they will sabotage it every move. And so that's one of the things, and when I say to prison people, or people, I try to make it plain to them that that's exactly what we're asking for. Nothing else. I don't want them to learn the traditions. I don't want them to come to meetings. Don't want them to be believers and go on 12-step calls. What I want them to do is be good at what they do. And the only thing we ask them to do is provide a place and a climate that will allow it to be done. That's all. If prison or jail people will do that, things work remarkably well. If they get out of that job description, I guarantee you they'll screw it up. One of the things that often happens is that staff members will get a little overzealous. And they'll want to come in and sit in on the meetings. It's always at the expense of the meeting. Because it breaks up that trusting environment. It's so critical. Sometimes it cannot be avoided. But at least we can negotiate how it's done. If prison staff get too deeply into the program, big trouble. So their job, my way of looking at it, provide an environment that supports and encourages what we're trying to do. The second group, I'm not going to talk about inmates in this job description thing, but underlying all this, I think inmates have a real responsibility in this whole deal, too. But that goes more into the internal group. I'm talking about the what in working out our cooperative relationship with folk. The second group, a lot of prisons have, and I imagine they do in Illinois, they have some special staff members who kind of coordinate these kinds of activities. Most states still have somebody who either looks after alcohol and drug programs or something like that. That's fine if they're there. But those are basically people who connect, they're the middleman, the middle person, who connects the administration to the people who come in from the A group. That's all. And so if they're there, they're great to use. They tend to not have much authority, but they've got the access to people who do. And so they can be useful. Their job is not to be in AA, not to be in administration. Their job is to be that middleman in between. And so they can be useful. The last group is us. And when we go into to a facility, we've got one job. And we state it all the time. Our job is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, period. Period. When we start to go beyond that and get into other stuff, it almost always creates trouble. I'll tell you what I've noticed over the years. It's not carved in stone, but what I've tended to observe with working with volunteers is that when trouble starts with a volunteer, it'll normally be on a fairly predictable kind of schedule. You'll find somebody who's going along doing a great job, and then they'll start to get irritated about something and need to meet with the administration on a regular basis or need to squawk about something going on. You find people who get into wanting to get the policy book and tell folks what the policy book says. And when we get into trying to run the prison, we almost always cause trouble. And so, very important, I think, for us when we go in there to remember we got one purpose, and that's all. Our CFC, I don't know what yours is here, but our CFC committee in North Carolina purpose says the first line, that the only purpose of the Correctional Facility Committee is to carry the message of AA to folks who can't get to it. And it says something about why they can't get to it. But that's what our purpose, that's all. That's all it is. And when we do that, man, we do that better than anybody ever has. And when we don't do that, we'll screw it up like Hogan's goat. And so that's what I've sort of come to believe. If we can think of ourselves in those kinds of compartments, you know, we can do some worthwhile stuff. Well, I've bounced around a lot of ideas. You want to chat a little bit about any or all of this? I'd be happy to do it. Yeah, right on the back row. Bill, I believe. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested in hearing some of the... Could you rub shoulders with other wardens?
A few what?
You rub shoulders with other wardens. Maybe there's a warden quarters production. I don't
yeah.
know. Some of the negatives they throw out about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know some of them must have some, and you've talked about a few, you know,
yeah.
They go in and try and change things and this type of thing. It just seems like, from what I've heard other members of our committees here, it is difficult to get in, to get cleared, and it's almost like some of the wardens really don't want it there.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that?
Yeah, you know, what Bill's talking about is what we run into with wardens who have negative feelings about Alcoholics Anonymous and what that tends to come from. Yeah, you run into a lot. It doesn't tend to be a fervent kind of thing. The biggest thing that I worry about with wardens is that they don't pay attention to it. You know, that they may not even know they got a group in their institution. Now that's what worries me more, the benign neglect that's implied in that. But you'll find people who do get irritated with what's going on, and very often it's what I said, is people who try to run the institution. I have a lot of people, not only wardens, but I have other staff who tell me that one of the things that they really don't appreciate about us when we go in is that we'll walk into an institution, walk right past a staff member, and go over and hug an inmate. treat the staff member like he was a piece of furniture. Well, you know, you don't think about that at first, but that guy's not furniture. He's a human being. It's hard for people to reconcile that. Now, who are these people coming in here, walking past me? I'm putting my life on the line, walk past me, go over and hug that guy. It's hard to understand. And, you know, it's that same thing about practicing principles. You know, there's not a thing in the world wrong with saying, hey, guy, how's it going? Amazing what that does for the quality of relationship. There are some things that happen that, well, I mean, I'll just tell it like it is, that sometimes we will, I say we advisedly, but sometimes we'll get out of line appreciably. And we'll take on causes that have nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a place up in, well, Montreal, Canada is where it was. Montreal, Canada is surrounded by 7 penitentiaries that are just within proximity to Montreal. Alcoholics Anonymous was kicked out of 6 of them. It only remained in 1, and I don't even know if it's there now. But it was kicked out of 6. And what it was kicked out about is, I don't mean anything sexist by this, but it's just the way it was. There were a group of women who got an activist kind of deal, wanted to make a social statement. And so they started using the AA group as a place to make social statements. And it gets away from what we're talking about. Well, it went from that to worse and got into some tremendously inappropriate junk. And as a result, Alcoholics Anonymous was kicked out of 6 out of 7 statements, prisons. And it could have been anybody. You know, it could have been anybody, but that's just what it was. So sometimes we will get caught up in stuff that's a way off track if we're not careful. And so it tends to be that kind of thing. A little bit of stuff with folks bringing in things that are not approved. You know, like there's always some lack of clarity about material. You know, people wonder why they've got such meatheads that won't let you bring a big book. But if you stop and think of the other side of that, one of the most common means of smuggling stuff is in material, written material. And so there's a policy that material can be received, but it has to be directly from a publisher. He and I were talking about that, about how you get tapes into one of these places. So it'll tend to be stuff like that that may just sort of skirt outside of policy a little bit, but can really snowball and become a major problem. I don't hear many people who just say, I just don't like that program. I rarely hear that. It's usually things that interfere with the orderly operation of that institution. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, my name is Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
Very cool to be here today. I've been on both sides of the wall. I was incarcerated myself. I was in the Illinois Department of Corrections for a couple of years, and members came in and shared, and you know, and I have been doing this for the last 4 years myself. I've been a coordinator at the Cook County Jail, which houses a lot of inmates. You know, there's like 5,000 inmates in there.
It's like a state system.
And it's continually growing. Like I said, I was a coordinator at the meeting there that's what kept me sober. You know, my first year in recovery, some guys asked me to come on in, and I've been there ever since, sharing, you know. And my responsibility was try to coordinate the meeting. But where I would go was, it's a treatment facility in the Cook County Jail. And they have the meeting set up, and they've been there for years. So it's once in a while, I'll get a bad rub from a correctional officer there, but the staff is really, you know, it's really good meeting, and it helped me stay clean and sober for years. You know, for 5 years I've been sober, and it's about bringing the message and showing that these guys that there's hope, because you know it was done for me. You know, and the gratitude I get after leaving the meeting is like unbelievable. And I've run into guys I used to drink and party with, and they would say, is that you, you know?
The new you.
Yeah, right. They couldn't believe it, you know. And, I have a situation in my life where I have some wreckage in my past that caught up with me, and I have to turn myself in on an old criminal case from 1994 So I'm going back behind the wall, you know. May 31st, I'm going to surrender myself to a federal correctional institution in Southern Illinois, Pekin, Illinois. But you know what? I know I'll have Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's one of the first things. One of the second things I did when I called the institution the other day, I asked about, you know, if I could bring certain things in, and then I asked, is there meetings there? And she said, yes. You know, you know, and I know I have a lot of support from the people in the rooms. And, you know, and I was blessed with the time I was supposed to get. I was supposed to get 4 years, you know, but the judge seen that I changed my life because of the program. I got sentenced to a year and a day. And I'm grateful for that, too. And I know God has a plan for me, and I don't know what it is. You know, what, maybe I'm going there to 12-step somebody. Maybe I'm going there to help myself. But, you know, I know. And like you said, when you're in that environment, there's a lot of negative things going on. And, you know, the only sanction you have is going to that meeting, you know. And, you know, I'm not going to run around with a big book and try to save people in there. You know, if they want to come to a meeting or they want some experience, strength, and hope, I'll be more than happy to give it to them. But, you know, I got to take care of myself first.
You bet. Well, you'll never, Tim and I talked about that a little earlier, that never be a better opportunity to serve. If there's anything that I think, there's no better preparation for having to go do some time than to take a program with you. And that's great. I think there will be some good work. Some of the most valuable stuff that ever happened to me was inmate to inmate on the yard. Yeah, good stuff. And so I surely wish you well with that. Hope you'll have a good experience. I think that picked up on the tape okay.
Yeah, I'm Mary Jane Fork, County Division 4 coordinator. And we started that when we have the inmates doing the part. They read, they run the meeting, and they have taken the meeting back into their cells and run it inside now. So, I mean, it's given me so much encouragement. They are working the steps, and they're talking the talk, and we let them bring up topics that are apropos to their situations. And they really have grown. I feel like it's a very encouraging thing.
Yeah.
I've had people tell me that I'm wrong to allow them to run the meeting, that I don't have control. But I feel like I do. And another lady, Elaine, and I have talked it over extensively. We both have a little 24 hours, and we decided it would be really good, though, to let them do it. And they do. They take over. They walk in. They pick up. They know who, you know, we tell them who's going to run the meeting because we don't know who's going to be there from week to week. But it's very encouraging. And I agree that they need to be participants.
Yeah, Mary Ann just commented about a group. What a great experience. She's commented about a group where they really are functioning as a real AA group. And I tell you, the quickest way to evaluate how you're doing is see what you do when you go in. If you're anything beyond a guest, take a look at what you're doing, whether you need to. Because a group like that, you walk in, it's pure joy, you know. Yeah, because you're going to find people hosting you, letting you know that they appreciate you being there. But you're not going to find people saying, now what do we do? You know. Yeah. Good stuff. Thanks. Somebody. Right here.
The comment you made about someone who was frightened of the situation being an inspiration for you, we've kind of gone on the idea that if someone was that afraid of the piece of air on the time of the being in the prison, that it would be better maybe if they didn't go. Obviously, that we feel different about that.
Well, he never came back, you know, for what it was. I'm just glad he came one time, you know. Maybe like Tim was there, maybe that was his job, you know. Yeah. No, I think if somebody is, anybody that's not a little uneasy walking into prison has got something wrong with them. I mean, man, that is not the mall, you know. And so, yeah, the mall is bad enough, you know, but that, there's a place. I mean, there's some people who really are not prepared to go in there. And it doesn't mean that you got to be an all-American, you know. The thing I've found that it's a judgment about when, it's usually a sponsor judgment about when somebody is, what I want to see is that they're out of themselves enough to see somebody else. You know, I don't want somebody in there who is so chronically looking at their own deal that they can't see the other guy. And so that's the barometer I use. I want to be ready to help see somebody else deal with them. And otherwise, people go in there to get what they need, a little shaky. And there are some people who just are not equipped. I've got some people I work with who are not equipped to do PI. Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things about working with people, and folks will find their place. And prison is not the place for everybody. I don't think it was a place for that guy. He never did come back. But he truly made a life-changing difference to me. Maybe that was his job. Yeah, but at least he got that done. Yeah. No, and I agree. I would not push somebody in there and say, go swim. You know, that would be irresponsible on my part to do that. Yeah. Yeah.
My name is Lauren. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Lauren.
My experience is a prison, and I both knew Jane and Lane. And at first, when we went, we were doing the meetings, and now we let them do it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's much better. And personally, on my own sobriety, I feel that I can be more honest with these young ladies. You know, because I've been there. I just haven't been caught doing what I can do. But, you know, I just think it's wonderful to have the ladies thank me, yeah, give me a hug, and ask me to be their sponsor, and whatever. You know, I just had a young lady ask me. I thought it was the most wonderful thing.
Yeah.
You know, and we have guidelines. We don't talk about how they got there. We don't talk about the cases at all. We don't introduce the hug. If they want to hug us, they can come to us because there may be problems. You know, and I respect that, and you know, and I like what you said about approaching the staff. You know, usually I get intimidated more by the staff than by the
They're more dangerous.
It's really amazing that I had experience where I had to talk in front of all the inmates.
Yeah.
And I gave a lead, and the deputy, she was in the program, and she came up and talked about it as well. And it was a wonderful thing, and I just personally does so much for my recovery.
Yeah.
I am real, and not putting all these fillers and putting that to make my story better.
Yeah, thanks, Laura. Laura was talking about her experience with the group and the value that it has to her. My own notion is that this kind of service is the closest thing to old-fashioned 12-step work that's available. That same old thing. And I forgot to put on the tape the thing the lady right behind was saying about the fear. She was questioning about pushing somebody into a prison who was still far too afraid to handle that environment. And so my response was in relation to that on that earlier question. Yeah.
One of the questions I get, one of the prison things, when I won't name it, we do it twice a year. Down southern Illinois, but the chaplain who coordinates the meeting always sits in it.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of like an AA wannabe or maybe an ACA person, or he doesn't want to feel excluded. And even though I'm not the coordinator of the meeting, a friend of mine is. I think we went in there first, you know, everything was checked to the bottom of your feet, and now it's like no check at all.
Mm-hmm.
And but I feel that the inmates are a little bit intimidated by him being there. They're not free, as you spoke about. And how do you change something like that?
What she's talking about is staff members sitting in on a meeting and being an obtrusive factor in a meeting. And it is, some places it's negotiable, some places it isn't. Some places are bound, it depends on the security level of prison. Some places has to have in contact supervision at all times. Lower levels from medium down don't usually have quite that stringent. So it depends on that as far as whether it's negotiable or not. Tell you what I like to do with a thing like that is, I'll give you an example. We had an excellent group in North Carolina many, many years ago that at one of the prisons, excellent group. And there was an officer who meant no harm by it. But the way we set up on a deal, and there was a staircase on either side that went up to the raised platform. This guy sat there for obvious reason, because it gave him a good view of everything going, and he could hear the speaker well, and he was a good guy. And but all the time the speaker's speaking, half the guys looking at him, you know. And so I just went to him one day and I said, look, I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job, but would you consider, just real nice like that, said, would you consider moving down to the other end of this thing? I told him, I said, people really are distracted by you're sitting that where you're sitting. He said, no, don't make it down to me. I'll make the same back there as I do up here. You know? So it was no problem. You know? He just had not, people who have not done group work don't understand how much you can mess up something. And so if it's negotiable, you may not be able to get him out of the room, but what we did is put him in the back of the room, and he was quite amenable to that. Some places, and that's important in that early negotiation when you're setting that up, is to look at level of supervision, and that our preference would be that there not be a staff member in there. And I mean, if it won't fly, it won't fly. But it's a good thing to negotiate. It's a little bit like that fear thing. When everybody's got some fear, most people learn very quickly. It may not directly impact this, but it ought to be a factor. Once you get known in an inmate population as somebody who's coming in there to help, you'll never be in a safer environment in your life. I don't care where you go. You're sitting on mama's knee, you ain't no safer than that. Because once they know who you are, now you give me a week, now if I just walked in and I'm the old warden from downtown, I'd be a little antsy about where I slept. But you give me a week in that place and I'll sleep anywhere. Because all I want folks to do is get to know me, you know. And we're not in war, you know. Our war is not with each other. Yeah. So, anybody else? Yeah.
John, I'm Paul Greff, recovering alcoholic from District 16.
Yeah. Hey, Paul.
Getting back to the issue of people walking by the staff as they're going in, wouldn't that go to the thought of somebody who's not familiar with it being concerned about the inmates wondering what side they're on? You know, if I go up and I shake the hand of the staff member, does that hurt my credibility with the inmate? You know what I'm saying?
I don't think it does. I think that probably picked up, Paul. Your voice carries well. And I don't think it does hurt credibility, because what it demonstrates is what recovered people look like. And we're not choosing sides. You know what we're trying to do is recruit people back into to society. And so, I would really never even worry about that. Because it's just a matter of good human relations. Very often when I go into a prison, I'll go over and shake a guy's hand. He may not want to, but I'm not going to ask him if he wants to. I'm going to go over there and just shake his hand. It's not about whether he wants to shake hands or not. I want him to know that I'm somebody who wants to greet. And some of it comes from just hearing that kind of thing, that people really, really get sort of angry and upset at just being ignored, you know, just walk by. So if you do nothing more, just said, hey, good to see you. You know, good enough. Whether they answer or not, doesn't matter. Because it's about who we are, not who they are. And man, I tell you, it just gets ridiculous how that works. I went to a prison, we're about quitting time. I went to a prison up in one part of our state, and I'm a fairly prominent figure in corrections in North Carolina, you know, having been trained everybody in the state, and so I'm fairly well known, you know. I walked up to, went to prison one Saturday. I happened to be up in that town. Somebody said, go over to the meeting with us to prison. I said, okay, fine. Medium custody joint, a woman outside sponsor who's been there forever. She's a wonderful, wonderful gal, guidance counselor in high school, wonderful gal. She said, go with us. So we go over, half a dozen folks, and I said, now look, I don't want to alert them that, you know, that some guy from the Capitol's coming in, you know, because they get antsy. I said, I just want to walk in. And she said, it won't be a problem. So I get in the middle of the huddle. Now I'm the hot shot from the Capitol. Officer on the tower didn't recognize me. He said, who's the fellow in the middle? And the lady said, oh, he's all right. He's with us. Gate flies open, you know. And I debated for a long time about telling that warden about it. He and I were old good friends. And I debated for a long time about whether to tell him about it, because I didn't want him to see that as a breach of security. What it was a demonstration of trust. That was a product of many greetings, much performance without question that it would be done. Yeah. And that, to me, those are important kind of things. I don't know how this will fit in, but let me just mention, I thought about it on an earlier question about the ideal. There's a man who's the warden of the penitentiary up in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, where my wife's from. And he's a great guy. He's about as tough-minded a warden as I've ever known. And the most pro-staff guy I've ever seen. I mean, that guy is an absolute staff advocate, and I'll guarantee any member on that staff would kill for him. Most inmates might kill him, but I don't think they would. I think they respect him because that's who he is, and they trust who he is. This guy made a comment. In fact, we had him speak at the International Convention in 85 in Montreal. And one of the things he said was, what a thing, if I could get every warden in the country to say that, I'd die happy. He said, the only thing in my institution that will not be shut down is the AA group. He said, I've stopped it twice in however many years he'd been there. One time was because of a full-scale riot that was underway. And he said, I debated about closing it then. And he said, that's not because I'm a wonderful fellow. It's because I've learned what a powerful AA group can do for an institution. He said, that's the greatest peacekeeper I've got, greatest management tool that I've got. And boy, if we could get people to see it, you know, rather than that reactionary thing like Bill was talking about, if you get people to see the value, that when you get people in this program, you don't have to worry about them. They become assets in your institution. Not problems. Yeah. Folks, we'll have to run. Thank you very, very much.